afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative Call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions following the presentation. Please be advised this call is being recorded. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Anne Wendland. Anne, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Erin. Good afternoon. This is Anne Wendland, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I would like to welcome you to today's call, Addressing Barriers to Treating Pregnant Women's Tobacco Use and Dependence. If you have not downloaded the slides for today, presentations and eventually all call recordings are posted on the collaborative call page of the New York State Smokers Quit site at nysmokefree.com. From the website's front page, click to on the Healthcare Providers and Partners tab, and then choose Collaborative Call. Click on the link for more information, and you will find the presentation. Our featured speaker today is Dr. Richard Windsor. Currently, Dr. Windsor is a professor of public health and an NIH Script Trials Principal Investigator with the School of Public Health and Health Services at George Washington University Medical Center. He has conducted research and authored several peer-reviewed articles on maternal tobacco use and cessation. On today's call, Dr. Windsor will discuss the relationship of smoking and secondhand smoke exposure to maternal and infant health. He will also describe the current best practice treatment for tobacco use, dependence, and exposure, and discuss successes and challenges in treating tobacco use in pregnancy. Before we start, I have some housekeeping items. We are pleased to offer CME, CRCE, and OASIS continuing education credits to listeners of today's presentation. To fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. Windsor has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation, nor does he have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies or any other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. To obtain continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which again are posted on the website. Please remember applications for credit will not be accepted after March 14th. That is 1 week from today. So please be sure to submit your application as soon as possible to receive credit. Now it is my pleasure to turn the call over to Dr. Richard Windsor. Dr. Windsor?
Thank you very much. I appreciate the introduction and especially the opportunity to share my experience and perspective with colleagues in New York. I know you appreciate the adverse effects. Almost all of you are aware of the clinical practice guidelines. I think the biggest challenge, as we will discuss in the next hour or so, is how do we take those guidelines and adapt and integrate and work with our colleagues in practice, both at the leadership, policy, and program level, but especially at the practice level, to integrate these methods into their regular practice, whether it's an obstetrician, family medicine, nurse practitioner, nurse midwife, social worker, WIC nutritionist, or health education specialist, depending upon the organization and the program. This is rather interesting because literally 30 years ago I'd received funding to do the first randomized trial with Medicaid patients from the National Center for Health Services Research. So this is an area in which I fundamentally, other than when I was a federal employee, dedicated about half of my percent effort, if you will, as a professor of public health to the area. So it clearly is an area of strong interest. We are going to be talking about barriers and obviously really getting into the nuts and bolts, especially in the middle and in the latter part of my discussion. And you can see my affiliation. Certainly, if any colleague wants to follow up on this call, I'd be more than happy to share methods, materials, et cetera, as I have throughout the years with colleagues throughout the, especially the United States, but actually globally. As indicated, I have no real or perceived interest. I've never consulted with any of the pharmaceutical companies, and at this point have no conflict of interest. I'm on slide 3, and I will summarize, really synopsis the relationships between smoking, active and secondhand, very brief synopsis of that, but especially focus on objective two. Here are best practice treatment methods, not because Richard Windsor says they are, but in fact, because of the consensus review and dissemination bodies in the United States have defined them as such through independent review. And then especially the latter part of my discussion is how do we integrate these into practice, because in fact that's where I've been for roughly the last almost at least 12 years, if not 20. Well, let's go ahead and start. This is slide number 4. Everyone certainly is aware that, in fact, the Healthy People Objectives 1990, 2000, 2010, 2020 all identified tobacco as the most modifiable cause. It's certainly the cause of multiple adverse events. The challenge is the modification part of it, and that's where we really need to focus on how we can take these methods out, because, in fact, they can assist another proportion of women. Everyone, I presume, is very aware of the relationship smoking-attributable risk in terms of smoking and low birth weight, its role in preterm delivery. It is accurate to say, defined by CDC, NIH, and any other national body, and in fact, the number one, and there's nothing literally close, cause of both low birth weight and infant mortality is smoking. So it is absolutely a national issue and has been for quite some time. Slide number 5. Everything the mother, unfortunately, inhales goes right into exposure in terms of fetal exposure. Multiple chemicals, nicotine, carbon monoxide, carcinogens, we'll talk about that in just very briefly in a moment, but especially carbon monoxide that lowers the oxygen. All of this inhibits, obviously, fetal growth, neurodevelopment in very, very microscopic ways throughout the pregnancy. And, of course, it's a vasoconstrictor, so less oxygen and nutrients get to the fetus. Effects on a wide range of adverse effects. I won't go through all those because I presume my colleagues on the call are really well-versed in these issues, and there have been dozens of sent consensus reports and continuing identification of new risks. In the role, now I'm on slide 7, with regards to the effect of active exposure during pregnancy. The last two slides, that is slide 8 and slide 9, are slides I've prepared because there's an article in draft form that identifies what we know from a variety of biochemical studies, how much, and these are just candidate 12 chemicals, carbon monoxide, ammonia, lead, nickel, and estimates per cigarette, and then what I've done is translate that into 5, 10, and 20. So you can see that in terms of, for example, nickel, you've got 1.6 million nanograms. Now, nanograms is parts per billion, by the way, so it's an enormously small amount. But all of these, there isn't any question that they're causing adverse events among the infant, but in fact, many of these, they've not been really able to isolate the specific effects. It's a point I make in this slide, number 8, as we'll comment on briefly in a few moments, is that I know there's risks in terms of nicotine replacement, but it is a fact that by only using nicotine, all of these other, and currently there's minimally 4,000 chemicals, and I've heard now that there's 6, they've identified 6 or 7 or 8 or 9,000 of them. So intuitively, if not scientifically, one would believe that by only exposing the fetus to nicotine, it eliminates all the other chemicals. And the note about 50%, there have been multiple studies, actually excellent studies in hospital, in which they've confirmed that women, whether they use patch or gum, and we've done some of these, in fact, typically receive only about 50% of that of nicotine versus active smoking. Slide number 9 reconfirms that this is carcinogens, the same issue. Obviously, with nicotine replacement, you don't get exposed to any of these carcinogens. So, you know, the takeaway message of those first few slides is there's an enormous amount of risk. Exposure for those 270 or some odd days, whatever the duration of the pregnancy is daily, and it's dose response. And so by active elimination of this, there isn't any question that we're dramatically helping that baby, that infant, that mother, and that family to reduce their risk. So that gives us a synopsis of risk. Let's now look at this issue, and it's a challenge because these rates are from CDC. These are PRAMS data. We could carry this up to 208, and it really wouldn't change very much. This basically says that for the last 20 years, and if you did it to the late 80s and took it up to the late 2008, that the prevalence has gone from 20% to roughly 10%. And realize that at 4,000 births or so, that's 800,000 versus somewhere in the ballpark of 400,000. That's an enormous reduction. But some fair scientific commentary. Everyone realizes that PRAMS data is postpartum. It's survey and or principally male, but also phone. And the response rate is 70%. And in fact, even though 70%, it's all self-report. As we're aware from multiple sources, and including myself and others, especially among Medicaid patients, we've confirmed anywhere from 25 to 50, almost 50% non-disclosure. So understandably, women are sensitive about the issue of not saying they smoke. So the point I make about all these rates, and, you know, I'm not trying to berate the Centers for Disease Control and PRAMS, I'm just simply saying as a scientist, these data are dramatic underestimates of the real prevalence rate. Now, if we look at a sister or parallel organization, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, many of you are aware since 1970 of the ongoing household survey. And they survey tens of thousands of individuals, representative sample, and these are data from the SAMHSA data at conflict considerably. Now, different methods acknowledge, different times acknowledge, but the SAMHSA data confirm, and if we track this to 208, 209, about 18%. So the SAMHSA data tell us it does not appear that there's been much progress. Below in slide 11, you'll note that there was a national epidemiologic survey done by Goodwin, published in Obstetrics and Gynecology, with the sample that said about 22% of the pregnant women smoked. So if you took CDC, you took SAMHSA, both of those different methodologies, both have about a 70% response rate, and neither have a biochemically confirmed actual estimate. Therefore, and again, I don't want to belabor it. I simply want to say I truly believe that the real smoking prevalence rate among pregnant women in the United States is closer to 20%. It's absolutely higher than 15%. And I think all organizations really need to take a look at these data in terms of being thoughtful and cautious about either progress or making statements about existing prevalence. We can discuss that perhaps in the question and answer period. Let's now turn to at least a snapshot of best practices. That is, throughout this period, and if you've worked directly in the area of smoking and pregnancy, this is slide number 12. In 2000, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality did a meta-analysis of this body of literature. I did not participate in any way. And this is actually a table on page 94 in that, in which the two randomized clinical trials that we conducted and published in American Journal of Public Health are cited. The work by Dan Ashoff, his group, and as you might expect, the actual number of individuals working in smoking and pregnancy, I won't say the world, but pretty close to that, is a very small number of individuals. It might be 10 or 20 max, and we pretty much know of each other and each other's work. Well, Raoul Walsh's work is in Australia, New South Wales, and Sydney, et cetera. And Dan Ershoff did his work with Kaiser Permanente, with Pat Mullen, et cetera. But fundamentally, the green citations relate to the trials that were done, randomized, biochemically confirmed, and demonstrated the efficacy of these methods. The last reference in the American Journal of Obstetricians and Gynecologists literally was published in January of 2000, about several months after the ARC guidelines came out. Basically, this tells us, and especially since 2000, it's 12 years ago, that, and with obviously a continuing maturing of the literature, that these methods are effective. We have a very good idea for black and white women, fundamentally, who are probably about 90% plus of the prevalence pool in the United States, and they work at least as equally well with both racial groups, et cetera. Obviously, the guidelines, and I was a reviewer of the guidelines for 2000 and 2008, and they reiterated the evidence and the methods that I've identified a few moments ago and present the meta-analyses. And it is a fair statement to say that since 2000, and actually to some surprise to me, there's been relatively few additional studies that have been done with this particular population. And slide 15 tells us the components of the psychosocial intervention. And basically, if you look at the reference to I and my colleagues' work, and incidentally, it's very important to understand that all of the work I've done has been in concert with, as I'll reinforce in a few moments about challenges, upfront beginning discussions with whoever is the leadership within maternal and child health, within prenatal care, with program directors, policy directors, whether, you know, physicians and nurses and social workers and WIC nutritionists. It's the consortia of collaboration that produces these evidence, not just me individually, although I and my group have been provided the leadership and proposed the different evaluations. Now, it's interesting that the work that was done by Dornelis was 90-minute counseling, bimonthly follow-up phone calls, monthly calls. And so the challenge here is, as we get into this discussion, in every case that I've ever worked, you know, over the last really about 20 years since the first evidence came out, all of my colleagues out in practice say, Richard, we're busy. We're absolutely, and I understand that. And we'll come back to that, I'm sure, in the discussion about how do you deal with the challenge of integrating this into a busy practice. Well, slide 16 again updates the 2000, is really the tobacco treatment guidelines in terms of the 5 A's. And, you know, the ask, the advise, and assess clearly are relatively low resource intensive types of activities. It's really the assist, isn't it? It's how do you have an active counseling process that unavoidably, if you want to be successful. Let me repeat that. In other words, what I'm saying is, best practices in every case that I've ever seen, and I've done other chronic disease management studies in asthma and high blood pressure and diabetes, takes more time. But it's especially not so much more time, it's more organized and more structured time about specific tasks. And we'll come back to that in a moment. So it's really the active assist part that we're concerned about and the arrange for brief follow-up over time. And we know that, in fact, pregnancy is the most motivating event for a smoker who becomes pregnant, that is a woman of childbearing age. The example I use in all such webinars or public presentations is the following. If you took a group of Medicaid patients or women of childbearing age who are Medicaid eligible and they smoke, if you followed a representative sample of those women 12 months later to confirm whether or not they quit, the quit rate would be between 0 and 5%. 0 and 5. If you take the same group, and obviously it's not going to be exactly the same group if they get pregnant, there'll be some covariance there, but by and large, women of childbearing age, Medicaid eligible, who smoke, and then become pregnant, that 0 to 5% kicks up to close to it, 20 or 25%. I know I've certainly done longitudinal studies with cotinine confirmed, so it's real. It's the most powerful event, and so the issue is how do we activate, how do we reinforce that at that first prenatal visit to help that woman with a quit attempt, because it's quit attempt that's the critical dynamic here. For women, you know, it says up to 60, this is slide 18, up to 60% of those quit during pregnancy will relapse within 6 months, and 80 or 90% by 12 months. If they're Medicaid, 90% will relapse in the first 30 days, almost certain. And then, again, longitudinal studies. And I'm not being negative. I'm just simply saying the pregnancy doesn't facilitate quitting. It facilitates stopping for that period of time. That is the other psychosocial, motivational, addiction levels are still there, relatively speaking, for that particular individual. And now she has a baby for whom she will be responsible for, and certainly that event, and I'm a parent, so even in the greatest of circumstances, one still has additional demands made when an infant enters your family circle. So no question, however, as the literature is unequivocal, women quit any time in the pregnancy is good, and that's well confirmed. Nicotine replacement, a big challenge. You'll see in a few moments, some of you may have seen in the New England Journal, March 1st, that's last week, Tim Coleman's study, the largest nicotine replacement study in the world, with 1,000 pregnant women within the National Health Service in Nottingham, England. Tim is a family physician, University of Nottingham faculty there. And as an aside, I was a reviewer for the Medical Research Council of England, UK, for this trial. It was not successful. That is, the NRT, in comparison to placebo, had no effect. The quit rates were about 7 or 8, 9% for both groups. And that's really disappointing. We'll come back to that in a bit. So, you know, certainly the guidelines stress this notion of adverse, and there isn't any question that nicotine in and of itself it causes adverse events. It affects neurodevelopment. And Slotkin's work is probably the work that everyone cites with mammals. But nevertheless, should be considered in the context, and that's that last note, nicotine from NRT, as I pointed out, versus the 4,000 or so chemicals and toxins, and we can talk about that. Next couple slides, and now I'm on slide 20. I and Cheryl Onken, Jack Henningfeld, Kathy Hartman, and Nancy Edwards. I was asked to write this for the Journal of the American Medical Women's Association in 99. I selected, as you can see, Cheryl Onken is the lead NRT. Cheryl is a faculty at University of Connecticut physician. I picked Jack Henningfeld. Jack is nationally renowned in his work in pharmacology. I asked Kathy Hartman, who I knew was obstetrician and PhD in epidemiology, who replicated work in Chapel Hill, asked Nancy Edwards, who was a nurse. So I wanted to get the medical, the nursing, the behavioral science, the pharmacology as a group. And you can see basically it was our opinion, and I think it's still the opinion consistent with the guidelines, that judicious use may significantly reduce the harm. The challenge is we have very, very scant evidence that the current treatment regimens for nicotine replacement are efficacious. Efficacious being they produce change in that specific study. I'm contrasting that with effective, looking at, okay, for the state of New York or for NYU or, half a dozen other medical centers, does it produce consistent evidence per site? And that's a real challenge. Really good review article, won't go through it. Neil Benowitz and Delia Dempsey have done some of the best basic science work with regards to the fact that pregnancy dramatically accelerates metabolism, and I would refer you to that work. And just getting a much, much better idea of what's going on, Coleman, that's Tim Coleman, the randomized clinical trial of NRT and patches in pregnancy, that's the New England Journal medicine article that just came out last week, and you can see that there was no quit. This is a randomized study done in 40 or 50 primary care set clinics throughout central England. No effect. Kathy Pollack's group, that's at Duke. And again, we've all had discussions with each other. And, you know, their trial, unfortunately, was stopped because of an adverse event. They did not find any association with the adverse event, that is the use of nicotine with it, but because of the protocol, they stopped it. You can see that at 7 weeks, there was an initial intervention effect, 24% and 8%. That is at the end of treatment, but is not throughout the entire pregnancy. As you can see, 3 months postpartum, there was some change, but relatively small. That's slide 21. Slide 22, again, Sherlockin's work, quit rate 18%. For experimental group, 15% for control, no significant difference, although there was some difference in birth weights, as you can see. But the issue here is statistical power and sample size, because, in fact, the total number per group were only about 100 or so. So we have to be thoughtful. Certainly, it's better that they were in the right direction, but you would need much larger samples to confirm that as being statistically significant. So that gives us... And I realize, it's a quick synopsis, but fundamentally that's where the field is with regards to nicotine replacement. It's currently in review, but I and Dr. Imana Mohandas, who is a neonatologist, have under review the first nicotine replacement study with African Americans that we conducted at 3 OB clinics here in D.C., funded by the National Center for NICHD, Child Health and Human Development. Unfortunately, that was not successful either. So I, to some extent, hate to be the bearer of negative findings, but that's where the science base is. Let's now look at successes and challenges. This is slide number 23. What exactly is the Smoking Cessation and Reduction in Pregnancy Treatment Program? That's the acronym that I've developed over the course of years, beginning with our first study, because I think it was an accurate description. Slide 25 simply tells us, and if you're familiar with the whole sort of NIH approach to working at the formative evaluation phase, that was the very first study we did to where we are now, in dissemination and adoption. That is, we have clinical practice guidelines. They've been out. We've had two sets, 2000, 2008. We have ACOG. We have Cochrane. We have all of these bodies independently saying we have a very clear a picture. We can define very specifically these are the methods that a professional who's trained should be delivering to their pregnant smokers in the context of any type of care during the course of pregnancy, whether it's home-based, clinic-based, telephone-based. We're ready, and we're at the stage of dissemination and adoption, and in fact, that's exactly the project I just finished with my colleagues in West Virginia. This is the Healthy Start Project for the state of West Virginia we'll comment on in a few moments. So slide number 26 gives us a synopsis. It says, okay, here is script, here are these methods, and these are the 10 studies with the experimental and control group quit rates, and these are all biochemically confirmed, as you can see, in terms of the measure. And so a realistic, and this is not negative, because I always say this, and this is very important to reinforce, the typical pregnant smoker is a Medicaid patient. She is obviously dealing with lots of other issues other than the economic issues that she's struggling with in her life, within family, within residence. And so we need to appreciate that. And when you combine the addiction perspective, we should be at least somewhat optimistic in the fact, even in the face of all those factors, we're able to still assist another proportion of pregnant women. The project we just finished in West Virginia, I'm calling it Trial 4 only for purposes of discussion. It really, you can see that the base rate for the women there was about 4 4.6%. We were able, delivering with fidelity by the regular providers. That is the trial three, trial four, et cetera, were all provided by regular providers. Each of those can be, you can go back into the literature and identify where the project was done. Gebauer was Columbus, Ohio. Kathy Hartman was North Carolina. And then the other two projects. And you see the work of Valbo in Norway, O'Connor in Canada, and Halmerson in Sweden. I basically shared the Pregnant Woman's Guide and all of our methods and materials and assessment instruments with them, and they replicated the work in specific cities and in prenatal care. So we know we can definitely assist, I think consistently, somewhere around an additional 8% of the women realizing the following. If it's 100 pregnant smokers, as I've said earlier, the 20 who could quit on their own have done so. So the 80 that are remaining that you and your staff, either in the quit line or home-based or clinic-based, they're more challenging. But even with that specific group, we have the capacity to assist the woman to quit. Well, Script follows understandably. In fact, obviously, Script contributed to the whole notion of ask, assess, advise, assist, and arrange, simply because it was funded by the National Cancer Institute for the last variety of years. And so we actively participated in the identification of the five A's as it relates to pregnant women. Three core procedures. You have a commit to quit video that's been specifically tailored. In fact, we have just finished in the last month the commit to quit video during and after pregnancy. The Society for Public Health Education is the organization to whom I have given these methods. In other words, they have it, and anyone's interested in the video, the Pregnant Woman's Guide, they have them available, and you can contact Sophie, go on its website, and I presume at least some of you are familiar with the Society for Public Health Education. It's a national organization, been around for 60 years. You have a New York chapter, absolutely, and I'm positive at least many people on the call would be familiar with it. So they have those methods and materials. This is the Commit to Quit video. Obviously, it focuses on risk and really understanding the risks and benefits of cessation. Pregnant Woman's Guide, been developed it and progressively been revised. This is the fifth edition, being very user-friendly, attractive, et cetera. Another important element in being concerned about what, it's just not what the physical components of the intervention is, but the importance of every site, especially if it's in the context of care, examining what happens to that patient who comes in who says she smokes, and this is slide 31, in terms of a patient or practice flow. Really understanding who she sees, how much time, et cetera, and this is a very standard methodology in most areas of disease management. Getting a very specific idea, where is the best time and who is the best person or persons to combine to deliver this evidence-based program. Critical step, in my opinion. There's a standardized provider counseling manual and guidelines that's available. If you sent an email to me, I'd be happy to share it with you. This is the specific 20-some-odd page guidelines that have been used in West Virginia, Alabama, other places to facilitate and actually used in a three-hour training program for primary care providers, and that's available to you. That's slide 32. Well, let's step back then and having defined at least briefly what the intervention is, let's look at some, I think, sensible ways to approach this whole issue. If your agency or organization, primary care agency or organization, saying, okay, look, how do we examine what we're currently doing and how should we begin to make some systematic steps to integrate these methods into your system? Well, the first and foremost is, question I ask everybody is how many pregnant smokers you have, and you'd be really surprised that, and I'm being so much negative, but an awful lot of organizations don't have a clear idea. And also realize even if you have a clear idea, you're very unclear about the extent to which there's non-disclosure. So you've got to start out with knowing how many pregnant smokers you have at each one of your sites and how large a problem you have, and obviously do some type of smoking history study over the course of 2 to 4 weeks using carbon monoxide or a cotinine assessment, of course, within informed consent to assess what your problem is. Now, in doing that, it's important for me to give you a snapshot of measurement, okay, in terms of active and passive. I'm going to really focus on active. There's certainly methods. Let me give you a synopsis about passive first before I get into the active, because that would take another sort of set of discussions more extended. Passive exposure takes some very unique methods because you can't just collect saliva. It'll give you some estimate of exposure, but it's not sensitive enough. You need much more sensitive methods. If you read Pearson Windsor in Public Health Reports in 2009, we collected saliva from bartenders who were in active smoking restaurants in 2006. But the method you have to use is a gas chromatography and mass spec, and that costs about $100 a piece. So, or you use the air monitors. So there's the science of measuring passive exposure is well understood. It's just simply very expensive to do it. And the literature's out there, and you would find it very easily. There's no question the passive exposure is detrimental to the infant, but clearly is nowhere near as adverse. Slide 35 gives you a very specific example of when I recommend doing a smoking history study. These data are from the smoking history study, and they're cited in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, 2000, in which regular nurses and social workers, 28 at 10 clinics representative of the state of Alabama, collected data, as you can see, from 416 women. Women knew we were going to be able to confirm their saliva. Well, current smokers, if you took the self-reported rate for this group of 400 women, this is all women, smoker, non-smoker, the self-reported rate was 25%. But look at the rates for women who said they quit once they became pregnant, group C, slide 35. 35% of the women said they quit before they became pregnant. 40% of the women said when they found out that they were pregnant, they were quit. You understand that's deception or non-disclosure. What we're saying is 4 out of 10 of those women said that they quit once they found out they became pregnant, and they did not. So, in fact, the cotinine-confirmed deception or non-disclosure rate is 24%. You can see the differential effects is primarily among the white pregnant Medicaid smoker as opposed compared to the African-American. What it means is that the real smoking prevalence rate was 40%. So there's an enormous challenge here. If you go to the one very good discussion of biochemical verification, this will give you some idea of different cutoffs. And in fact, if you look at the literature, you'll find that they're different as well. This is slide 36. Certainly, if you review some bodies of literature, this slide says 15 nanograms as a cutoff. Our data with thousands of pregnant smokers using both cotinine and carbon monoxide in self-reports basically say up to 20 nanograms would probably be just as accurate. So you need to look to this body of literature to guide you with regards to the measurement. One of the studies we did, this is published in 2002, Nicotine Tobacco Research, slide 37, we actually bought manufacturers, they didn't know it, and independently tested, this was New England Script. This is the project I mentioned that I did in collaboration with Tom Lasseter and Donna Parker at Brown, funded by NIH, in which we used gas chromatography, urine tests, and found that the urine strips are very, very accurate to distinguish between smoker and non-smoker. And this is one of the first studies. There have been others that say these are very accurate and relatively inexpensive method, I think, but I'm not certain. You'd have to go back to the manufacturer. I think Nymox and some others. I have no interest in any of those that is financial or other conflict of interest with any of those companies, but they're very good. So we have an excellent body of literature with regards to measurement, and slide 38 gives you a good assessment of that. Well, what evidence then, and this will be the last one, the last parts of our discussion will open up, what evidence, because it's obviously a challenge, is available that regular prenatal care staff, and principally the primary providers of smoking and pregnancy counseling methods, are nurses and social workers. WIC is involved in, to some extent, but it's been my experience, relatively small. So is there evidence that says regular staff can deliver these methods that I've described with fidelity? And fidelity is all seven methods. That is, are they assessing the client? Are they intervening using the three-component script method? Are they assessing in terms of follow-up? And basically, all of this can be synthesized into a basic concept of a process evaluation model, because procedure and process basically says, what are the key procedures? Were they delivered? To whom? How much? When? Where? And where's the evidence? And, of course, the evidence is from direct patient contact. And so certainly one of the things the group needs to be concerned about, this is slide 40, is what are we doing now? And why? Or what do we want to introduce in terms of new best practices into our prenatal care system, into our OB or prenatal care practices? And it's challenging. There's no question about that. But my experience has been if the group is working together up front, they can over time, if they're patient and work and obviously have some level of resource, can achieve this. Slide 41. Slide 41 is really meant to reflect this philosophy, namely, how do you bring the scientist at the table? How do you bring the policymaker? Who's the director of this specific OB or prenatal care program? Who are the program directors? Who are the colleagues out there in practice providing it? You need to have these individuals, these stakeholders and these partners at the table at the front end begin to plan any smoking history study, any staff training project, any pilot test to integrate them into your system. And so they need to be partners at the table. And clearly, the science issues that we're discussing drive it. But fundamentally, the science issues, you can count them on your hands. You must confirm independently because of the high non-disclosure rate. You must count exactly what a provider has provided to what client. And that's confirmed in terms of National Commission of Quality Assurance with regards to what specific services were provided to the patient. So you need those, including obviously in slide 41, you need the insight from people, from the patients. And you could say patients or people, the exact same thing, to give you insight about the acceptability and their perceived quality of the methods. Well, I've defined a few moments ago what the script evidence base is in terms of assessments, and I just use O as an observation and treatment as the next. Don't worry about that. But what should they provide for visit 1, 2, and 3? And I'm not saying you shouldn't stop reinforcing at visit 4, 5, and 6, but my experience has been that the success is going to be relatively, it's going to happen in those first 2 or 3 months, that is, first prenatal visit in, say, week 12, 14, 16, second prenatal visit, which is typically a month later, third prenatal visit, it's probably going to be at the end of the second trimester or the early third trimester. It's during that period that you're going to have the success, if you're going to have success at all. So what I'm saying is it's this committee. Some type of committee needs to be put together. These partners need to be sitting down and talking about these issues and ask the question, how do we fit this into our program? And that's slide 42. Understand that, as indicated in slide 42, we don't need any, I'm being a little bit playful here, but we've done enough meta-analyses. We've got Cochrane, we've got ARC, we've got the NIH reviews, we've got ACOG reviews. We really know what the methods are as to how to assess unequivocally smoking status and progress, and we know what the methods are, and they're not resource intensive, and they really are not intensive with regards to a great deal of time. So it's the challenge is to figure out, what are we doing now? How do we fit that into our existing practices? Now, slide 44, keep in mind the slides numbers are out of number. You know, they're not the exact same number of slides because I've taken them from a much more extensive PowerPoint. there are other issues and barriers. This is slide 44. What's the current policy? What's the current structure? What methods are we using? That's feasibility. What about acceptability? What's the staff skill? Have your staff had any training in smoking cessation? When we went out to West Virginia, they had none. I mean, literally almost none from the beginning. Well, that's an enormous challenge because you have to provide staff with the ability and the skill, whether it's using a new IV injection device or a smoking cessation method within that practice. Is the evidence clear about efficacy and effectiveness? And then how much is it going to cost and issues of that sort? All of these issues and factors are described exhaustively in the body of literature, and without belaboring, in fact, if you looked at the 40 papers that I and my colleagues have published on this topic, it covers all of this in great detail and complemented by the literature. We have a lot to guide us. In terms of cost and efficiency and cost benefit, the first dollar, and I am biased about this with regards to tobacco control in any state, should be focused on mothers and babies for a lot of obvious reasons. Healthy mother, healthy baby, healthy family, but it's the most likely, cost beneficial assessment and investment that you can make. If you look at the whole issue of what should be provided, I know you're familiar with the National Committee for Quality Assurance. This is slide 45. You've all heard of HEDIS. And basically what I'm proposing in terms of the process evaluation model for a program and performance metric for a provider is just that. These are the analog of HEDIS, but much more specific to smoking and pregnancy. If you want more specific discussion of this, you go to Tobacco Control 2000. I was the lead science advisor for the National Program Office of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Program Office in University of Alabama, Birmingham, Department of OBGYN. Bob Goldenberg was the director of it. I developed what I'm about to discuss, and we published it with the input of a wide range of colleagues as a process about performance metric and process evaluation model for any system. Let's go right to the evidence. In other words, having developed this and used it with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation various projects, where is the evidence that script can be provided on a regular basis by regular staff? Well, slide 47, I'm going to walk you through it because it's really probably the most compelling evidence, although we have the same evidence, not quite as good. This is clinic-based. It's 10 randomly selected clinics. These are a representative sample of women, and it's the seven core procedures we talked about a few moments ago in terms of baseline assessment. A process evaluation confirmed that 6,514 patients were screened over 3 years, really over 3.5 years. 77% of the eligible smokers agreed that they wanted the program. That gives you a base rate because of all the studies we've done, basically almost all of them have ranged between 75 and 90% with regards to pregnants wanting to receive this program. This is clinic-based. Let's walk you through it. Regular staff, this is 28 nurses and social workers, collected 100% of a very one-page baseline form, 82% of the follow-ups, 99% of the baseline and 72% of the follow-up saliva samples, and especially as it relates to the script intervention. They provided the video to 95% of the patients, the guide to 99%, and counseling to 97%. These are 549 women. And this is in Health Education and Behavior, August of 2011. If you look at this visually, this is slide number 48. So for every 100 eligible patients that came into these clinics, as it might be in any one of your clinic-based programs, they recruited 77%. Our performance standard or metric was 80%. All of the procedures after that were to be delivered by that nurse or social worker to that patient. And then the follow-up is the follow-up assessment and the follow-up cotinine. When you pull all this together, The program implementation index was 0.95. What this means is that we are clear that those 544 patients received this. This confirms the fidelity of the delivery by those staff in that system. This is just an example of a teleform that the patients use or the staff use to document exposure. Slide number 50. Yeah, I'll be done in about 60 seconds. This slide is just simply a slide with the aggregate of West Virginia, where we started in 2003 and basically almost approached the 80% fidelity rate, but relative success. This is a home-based program. So previous slide, clinic-based, this slide, home-based. And the last two slides, 51 and 52, really present a synopsis of where we are in this area. These are general guidelines. One, we have an excellent base. The importance of organizational policy, program practice, consensus development, working together. Good communications, a realistic dissemination plan, obviously a parallel budget with some with adequate resources. Starting out with systematic assessment, conducting a smoking history study, training, assessing staff and patients, training the staff on the new assessment and new skill methods, doing the patient flow analysis at each one of the sites, pilot testing that, and then bringing it back for some final level of discussion to roll it out that, yes, we can deliver this, and this is helping our patients. So in the final analysis, slide 52, it basically says wherever your organization is, whether you're involved in a clinic-based program, home-based program a la Healthy Start, or telecounseling, motivational interviewing by telephone, ask yourself, where are we? You know, the whole issue of evaluability assessment, what's the reality of where we are, and have we really identified these various challenges and barriers, and have we laid out a realistic plan to begin to address them? Let me stop here. I realize that I've given you a very full smorgasbord of information and insight. Perhaps it's a matter of having worked in a field for 30 years that you're trying to synthesize that and giving you the very explicit insight is sometimes even for me a challenge. But nevertheless, I'm delighted to have given you the review, and at this point I will stop and then open up for any range of questions that you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Windsor, for your very informative presentation. This is Pat Bax from the New York State Smokers Quit Line. I'm the marketing coordinator, and I want to thank all of our participants for being on our call today, and also welcome anyone who may be new to our conference calls. The New York State Smokers Quit Line is here to assist in that, to help your tobacco users become and stay tobacco-free. And today we have Lori Krupski, who is our training coordinator for the New York State Smokers Quit Line, and she's here to share more about how the Quit Line helps women who contact us and women who are pregnant or breastfeeding. Lori?
Yes, thanks, Pat. Yes, coaches at the Quit Line are prepared to offer coaching and support to pregnant women who call to get that quitting assistance. And it's important to know that the focus is on the benefits for both the mom and the baby, you know, as well as everyone else who might be smoking in the household who might be interested in quitting. You know, and coaches recognize the prevalence of relapse, and therefore they send them a pregnancy starter kit. And that's really brochures, fact sheets. It helps to guide them both while they're pregnant as well as beyond. So really we can help them throughout their entire process to be smoke-free. And then additionally, you know, coaches encourage moms to discuss NRT and other stop smoking medication options with their healthcare providers so they can be monitored for their safety and effectiveness. So, you know, above all, moms are made aware that they can really keep calling us for support at all stages of their pregnancy and beyond. So, hopefully this clarifies our services, and then back to Erin.
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. If at any time your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. We ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. We do have a question on the line from Christine Harding. Christine, go ahead.
Hi, I don't basically have a question. I'm a maternal child nurse at Public Health here in Lowellville, New York, and I'm also a smoking cessation counselor. We've also adapted a baby and me smoking program, which if my clientele quit during their pregnancy and remain smoke-free after they deliver, which we monitor with a CO2 monitor, they receive a $20 coupon for disposable diapers at our local Walmart. And I found through my prenatal visits, I continue with, we use the script method also, that we found that that works the best, the script method plus the addition of the diapers. I've had, over the past 5 years, I've had 12 clientele that have gone a complete year after their delivery smoke-free, which I think is awesome. I don't have as big a clientele, obviously, as most of the areas do, but I think that is a wonderful thing. I think any number of clientele that we can get to continue to quit smoking, I think, is great. But I'm very proud of our area for having done this.
This is Richard. I'm delighted that all of the colleagues out there that are providing direct services and care to pregnant women who smoke. It's really that aggregate commitment and ongoing implementation of the widest range of methods that fit your setting, your system, and your particular patients. We have individual projects, although I didn't mention it. We also typically, because it's part of the normal system, would provide modest incentives, not so much monetary, but in terms of the ability of the woman to buy little gifts for their child or to give them bibs and other whatever types of methods that can be used. I think my colleagues right there at the sort of the interface of practice are in the best position to sort out how can we take where the evidence is in these methods and integrate them into our practice setting. And that's really the key and the challenge that you're talking about.
There are no other questions in the queue at this time.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share this with you. And if my colleagues on the call or in some subsequent discussion would like to discuss this further, I'd be happy to do that. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Windsor. That was very informative. Okay. I want to let everyone know that our next collaborative call will be on Wednesday, May 2nd. It's entitled Overcoming Barriers to Treating Cancer Patients' Tobacco Use. The start time for the call will be 12 p.m. Our speaker will be Dr. Jamie Ostroff, who will discuss challenges and strategies to help people with cancer stop smoking or using tobacco. On behalf of the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program, the New York State Cessation Centers, and the New York State Smokers Quitline, I want to express our sincere appreciation for the excellent presentation today and thank all of you for participating in today's call. This brings us to the end of our call. Thank you again and have a great rest of your day. Take care.
This does conclude today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.
Okay. Diane?